Got it.
Yeah, we're gonna immortalize you now.
Okay. I think I'm more qualified to speak maybe from the standpoint of where, not so much where radio as an industry is, but how about radio or broadcast education? Because that's obviously where my experience has been. And sadly, the state of broadcast education, radio education in particular, is not a good one right now. It's not a good one because young people are simply not tuning into radio. This generation, certainly not the one, my generation from two generations ago, and hardly even radio from when I look at my two sons and how little role radio plays in their lives. So as adults, I'm concerned about the future of the industry, for the same reason that I'm concerned about the future of radio education. We don't have as many people listening, and certainly from my perspective and my vantage point, don't see nearly as many people interested in pursuing a career in radio. How's that for a start?
That's a good start. Does anybody want to start asking comments or questions to Bruce? Go on, Mike. Yeah.
I sent something around to our local station board members recently. One of the most recent Project Censored programs ended with a 15-minute segment on a new study that's coming out, which is about the tremendous successes in alternative media. And what they mean by alternative media is exactly the kind of media that matches Pacifica's mission statement. We're not talking about music stuff. We're talking about content that the legacy corporate mainstream media is not providing. And they did 15 minutes on why they're succeeding, you know, why they're surpassing cable, etc. You know, some of these shows have now jumped ship from some corporate origins. And, you know, so for instance, you've got Crystal and Sagar that left The Hill. They're, you know, extremely successful. They're, I would say, to the left and much more challenging than what you get with Democracy Now. You know, could easily be added into the mix. But what's interesting is all the lessons that you get on why there is such tremendous success there. And it is almost all internet-based, which is part of a story of what's going on with radio. But terrestrial radio cannot be censored the way that the internet is being censored incredibly right now. I don't know if people are paying attention, but I think just in the last week, Consortium News was taken down and was doing something on Palestine, and Status Quo was doing something on Medicare for All, broadcasting from the Capitol, and 2 hours of its feed were taken down as they were covering Marianne Williamson and Susan Sarandon. But if you haven't paid attention to last report, the report's not out, so this was a discussion of the report that is coming out. I haven't contacted the author to see if they specifically were addressing Pacifica at any point in the report.
That's very interesting, Michael. Well, that's sort of interesting, Bruce, because, you know, Michael raises a question of all these different methods that have risen in the past 20 years to deliver information visually and through audio forms. And I wonder what's your thoughts about that? Because he's talking about, you know, sort of a different market segment that we're familiar with in Pacifica. But in general, you've had these trends for the past several decades with the new technology. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that.
Good question, because I think my professional perspective and my personal perspective are probably very closely aligned. I think I think the evolution has been wonderful. It has just opened the doors to so many things, to the possibility of so many things that, well, it was this summer, 50 years ago, that my hometown radio station owner had, I don't know if it was a mistake or not, but nonetheless, he put me on the air when I was a junior in high school. And when I think about what we had for dissemination then, as opposed to the methods that we have now, you know, who would have ever thought, even maybe 40, 30 years ago, that we would be where we are today? And I, again, personally and professionally, just embrace podcasting so wholeheartedly. I walk about an hour for exercise each morning. And, every day I'm listening to, well, I can't say every day a different broadcast, but I am listening to a podcast, every morning when I go out. And just to think that, you know, 15 years ago, that wasn't possible. I'm glad that we are where we are right now.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Mike, this particular project, you know, what's interesting you raise about this is that, you know, what it shows you is how all sorts of different people are doing all sorts of different creative things. But, Tom, you want to chime in with something? Do you have a comment or question, Tom O'Rourke? You need to unmute. Or Kenny? Let me continue the conversation. So yeah, go on, Tom.
I was going to say, no, not at the moment. I was distracted. So I'm back, but I'm just listening.
All right. What I find interesting, and I'm sort of curious to get your thoughts about it, Bruce, cause Michael was talking about, you know, this, you know, we've had also accompanying the growth of digital media. And digital broadcasting, we've had the growth of all these different kinds of controversial lawsuits, the creation of the Digital Millennial Act. We've had the promises of the internet radio, but then that sort of got shut down a little bit with the way it's now being regulated by the DCMA. That is, you can't do the freedom to do things is not the way one thought. And what I find fascinating, at least in New York, is in the borough of Brooklyn where we operate, there are 35 pirate radio stations operating right now. And people just say the hell with it. We're going to just do what we want. We're going to express what we particularly want to do and do that anyway, even if we interfere with your analog signal. And we have about four or five people interfere with our analog signal right now in New York. But I'm just curious about your thoughts about all this bouillabaisse we're in right now and how further, what do you think an analog radio station can do or it should do in terms of, riding with it, exploiting with it, leading it? What is your thoughts?
You know, if I were an analog radio station owner, I'd admonish myself to change my way of thinking, to change my viewpoint. I make content. How do I disseminate it? But you really touched on through the DMCA, that aspect of all of this is particularly interesting to me because, while on the one hand, we have benefited so much from, the technology, the ease of dissemination and the multiple ways. But thanks to copyright law, so much content is not going to pass through that gate, not in the current state. And I know this discussion was not intended to be directed toward music, but again, from my perspective as an educator, one of the most difficult situations that I faced in probably my last 10 years of teaching was to educate and help a student to understand why they couldn't do a podcast that had all of their favorite music in it. They just, intellectual property is just not something that they understand too well and don't want to understand very well. And if it's out there, if the content is out there, it's free for them, in their minds, free for them to use in any way that they see fit. And they think that they can just put a disclaimer up that absolves them of any legal responsibility. You know, it's just, it's sad that there is so much education that needs to be done in on that level.
Yeah, yeah. I went to a meeting where there were a bunch of attorneys from the entertainment industry there. This is a few years ago. And the whole issue was precisely this. The question of some of these attorneys were going after podcasts that were using music illegally. And they were very sharkish about it. You know, I sort of had to keep my big mouth shut because I realized that, you know, I was coming from a place where everybody was violating this all the time. But it posed a real interesting question because, you know, I sort of felt it was artists are going to create anyway. They're going to use sound and create anyway. And I know that Pacifica, we've had in the history of Pacifica, we've had lawsuits with Walt Disney, over people going into Disneyland and making sound documentaries about Disneyland, which were quite funny. But they got sued by Walt Disney because Walt Disney, of course, is very, very conscious of copyright. But that's an interesting question. Like, how do you see this moving forward with the copyright issue? Because to me, that's one problem. The other problem is the thrust towards this antitrust, you know, whether we like it or not, the questions of Facebook and Google and YouTube and everything else, which, as you know, drive in some ways the replacement of radio in terms of content producing. And I'm just wondering your thoughts about that too. Can you hear me?
Jim, was that question, were you directing that to me?
Yes, I was.
I'm sorry, I thought I heard you direct that to Michael. I'm sorry.
No, Mike is, Mike and I know each other pretty well. We're interested to hear your thoughts today, Bruce.
Can I ask you to reiterate?
Well, basically the question of, the attacks on Facebook, Google, and all the big giants we're having right now going on, which we know is going to lead to some sort of revision of the laws that pertain to them in terms of content producing. But how do you see that affecting radio? And then secondly, this issue of copyright is a perplexing one because, in a way, the DCMA – when it sort of put the mox nicks on being able to do internet radio freely, it's an interesting conundrum. And I'm wondering your thoughts about how we move forward, or is there ways to change it, or are people going to do whatever the hell they want to do anyway?
Well, I think they're going to do whatever the hell they want to do anyway. Isn't that always, it always seems to be the case. I'm in Southeast Missouri, so I'm not in a place where pirate radio, at least to my knowledge, is all that prevalent. But as far as the copyright issue is concerned, so we're what? DMCA was what, 1998, if I recall.
Right.
So we're 23 years into, that new land of copyright restriction, just an understanding of protections for intellectual property. And, you know, from where I sit, I don't read too much about any type of policing of activities. Every so often, maybe there is something high profile that comes along, but by and large, it I don't know, does it go back to Napster? Are we, what happened in file sharing, is that a basis for comparison with the use of protected content in podcasting? I don't know, but you know, 23 years of history just suggests to me that it's still the Wild West out there.
Yeah, yeah. Other people, you.
I wonder if the copyright issue should also be analyzed as something that is in a strange way driving people into the internet and towards big tech. So we're very involved with a lot of people doing music, and people routinely go to YouTube these days, which is Google, for their music, and I could certainly have a better appreciation of it, but Google has basically sort of papered over somehow the copy, a lot of the copyright problems associated with music. We've mentioned David Kenny's show on WBAI. It goes up, it's in the archives, I think, for a week or 2 weeks, or 2 weeks, I think. But then if you want to listen to a show archived after that, I think he's on places like Mixcloud, and I think Mixcloud has done something to address the copyright issue. It's also where you can find Radio Deluxe and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, as you know, Bruce, all radio, at least in public radio, we have to go through a process where we submit the use of licensed radio all the time on shows to get passage for it. Kenny, you were about ready to say something?
Yeah, how did you know?
I could see you jumping there, guy.
Oh, jumping around, getting empty. Yeah, I just trying to, I wanted to say this. I'm going to go backwards because I just got a bright idea. And I did have two comments. But the bright idea was this. We can sell a license to nonprofit organizations like libraries and universities to provide access to our archive on tiered levels. You know, going certain price for the last 10 years, higher price every additional 10 years you go back. And then they can then distribute that license to their members, like their library members or their students or their professors. That's a place where we could sell things for money and not deny the public. In other words, as I didn't get the name of the gentleman who just spoke. Let's say the show's on the on a local archive for 30 days, 90 days, then it goes into archive. Well, that's fine. So that's our service to the public. It's our members get the same service as anybody who logs onto the internet. So we don't give any privilege to our members in terms of access to the archives. So, and people get touchy about that. Say, what are you in this for the money? Is this, what is this, for profit? So that's fine. But we can do it by selling it to nice, clean, nonprofit universities and research institutions and libraries and so forth. And we can actually do that worldwide. And we know we just can't do it through the government. So the government's has to go get a library card if they want to listen to our archives. But I'm just saying that's a bright idea of income. Because we had one guy who did this. He wrote a syllabus. His name is Lamont Yakey. He's a professor in one of the colleges near Pomona. And he wrote a syllabus on American history. And it required the students to listen to some archive tapes. Right. So then the archive put together like a drive, you know, a flash drive for them. And he sold them. Now, the smart thing would have been to market that syllabus to other colleges. I don't think that happened because that's a little bit over the initiative that's available in our collection of people, you know, to be that, industrious or that Barnum and Bailey, that marketing interest. So that's just a bright idea I wanted to get out of the way. Then I want to say, what is the name of the generation that fought World War II and the Korean War? What do they call them?
The greatest?
Oh, the greatest, yes. So that was the greatest generation. After that came the boomers, and they were the generous generation. They donated to everything. And now you got this young XYZ, millennials and so forth, and they just want everything for free. And you know, to keep up with them, I used to do that too. You download stuff on Pirate Bay. You don't pay for it. You buy a box that lets you watch all the cable TV shows for free. You do whatever you can to get everything for free. In addition to which, there's now, I think it's like 3.5 billion. I'm just guessing 3.5 billion smartphones in the world for 7 billion people. There's such a plural, you know, they're just everywhere. I have 2 or 3. In the house, there's probably 5. So that has turned us into much higher degree of spectatorism as opposed to participation. Where we, you know, yeah, we go out for walks and sports and everything. It hasn't killed actually living, but it has increased spectatorism. And I've seen friends whose children, you have a, you know, you take them out for a walk and they're just looking down at their phone as they're walking. You got to like walk in front of them so they don't walk into a pole. It's so obsessive. It's beyond being a joke. But the factor of it is not obsession with the devices, but spectatorism. You can get much better sex for free on a phone than all the effort you're going to make to hope that you're going to maybe experience something exotic. You know, now you can do anything, ducks, whatever. And so it's turned to spectatorism and people who want stuff for free. So that when you're looking at the audience and what they're going to pay for and this, that, and the other thing, I see a lot of support going into people through Patreon and GoFundMe and things like that on the internet. And I go to the internet because yes, I get my fix. It's satisfying. It's gratifying to hear somebody explain something that I've already agreed to and he says it well, or he justifies it, or he gives me the history on why, how it got to that point. And, you know, and you have your thing. It's sort of like going to church where you're here to, if you believe in, fire and brimstone, you want to hear a preacher explain it and why we all deserve to go to hell and what it's like when we get there. But if you believe in a graceful God who forgives everything, then you want to hear that preacher. You know, we're all sinners and there's nobody here who's got here for free and we all have something to be forgiven for. So you want to hear that guy. So that is one of the attributes that you get through the media. And you can do it very privately, you know, sitting in your lounge chair and looking at the smart, at a phone or watching it on TV by yourself. But you don't have to go to a big event and go outside. So those are the factors that we have to contend with and also have to consider how big is the niche market that we can grab if we're just going to go for the niche market? Like we've all had stories about niche marketing, like the, old time radio program that's still playing on BAI and once a month in, on KPFK or, reggae music or, a cappella music or things we like, you know, the car show or the, science programming. And, you could see, and I don't, people say you got to do survey off, audience surveys, but I think you can just look at what other channels are running. You can see what's in NPR's grid. Oh, and the last thing I wanted to say was this. This is a personal thing. I can't say I can validate this with statistics. There are products out there that are produced programming, and there's programs that are not produced. Let's say Joe Rogan is not produced. He sits down and starts talking. They may edit it and cut out this and that. And he puts up stills, but it's basically a yik-yak of two people talking. He's just a very good interviewer. But other programs like WNYC Radio Lab is incredibly produced. It's like a Ken Burns show each time. It's just put together with all kinds of sound effects. And there's a network of programs like that in a group called Radiotopia. And I'm glad I kept talking because that wasn't my point, but I'm going to get to it because I just remembered what it is. So there's the production. I think produced radio is much more valuable. even, I'm going to say this, and everybody on this has heard this program, and now you know the rest of the story. And that guy ran with that program for years, and it was just a piece of produced radio thing, set up with suspense, time, scripted, and he delivered it. And bang, that's what I mean by produced, as opposed to like, well, what did you do this summer? Like the kind of show we're having here, which can be entertaining. But so produced programming, and this was the other thing. I just came to, and what for me is more of an epiphany, it's obvious. There's two activities involved at Pacifica. One is distribution, the other is production. All of the radio stations, the five stations, they're very proud of their production. You know, we produce 24, you know, we produce all these shows. We produce 200 shows in KPFK. And we send it out to about 200 people who listen at any one time. It's sort of like pointless. Because as the relatives of the broadcasters move out of the state, our listenership goes down. So it's too small a listenership. We have to view those two things separately. What I mean is we can produce programming if it sustains itself more than just on that radio station, but it's popular on the other stations and on the distribution network we have for the rest of the country, the affiliates. You can't just have it be popular. It's got to be very popular. And then we can use our distribution system, which is the five stations and the affiliate directory. I forgot what it's called. Radio something. We can distribute.
Audio port.
Yeah, we can distribute content that we acquire. It doesn't have to be something we produce. Now, we're doing that with Democracy Now!. We have once in a while, KPFT broadcast BBC content. They had to subscribe to NPR to do that. But we can contact the podcast people and say, hey, here's a hot podcast. Let's see if we can make a deal to put this on the radio to get us some goddamn audience because it's an interesting thing. Like, and it could be a crime story. Or it could be the story of the American Indians, but it's going to be produced radio podcast. It's not going to be Oprah Winfrey talking to the Duke and Duchess of somewhere.
Right.
It's going to be a produced program, like I think it was called Criminal or Crime, the one that was like had the highest podcast listenership.
Serial.
That was it. Yeah. Or shows, or any of the shows on Radiolab. I remember, I'm going to stop talking right after this, but it's a little anecdote. I don't have anybody to talk to here, you know. Anyhow, there was a program on Radiolab where this woman starts in about how my son's eyes became the most important thing in my life. Something like that, right? That was the lead in. And I go, oh my God, change the channel, please. You know. Let's get something, let's get some crime radio on here or something. What happened was this woman, her child died like when he was 2 months old or 2 weeks old. She donated his eyes to science, to the hospital. And then she followed up and saw the story of what great benefit, what research was done and who got a new cornea and so forth. And it was very touching, very touching. And it was because it was well produced. With intrigue, mystery, suspense, revelation, you know, a good ending, and so forth. Now, a program can be overproduced, but a well-produced program, it's like a full meal. It's not like, oh, here's the ham, here's the cheese, I don't know, I don't have any bread, there's no mustard, put some salt on it. No, it's here's the ham sandwich. You got the ham, you got the cheese, you got maybe mustard, you got rye bread, you got the whole thing, and not only that, gave you a cup of Joe on the side. You want produced radios. So we don't have to do that. We can acquire those because it's like when you go into a used bookstore. You know, everybody wants to be an author and look at all these books in the used bookstore that, you know, you don't know the names of these things. Yeah, you look for ones you already know, like Spinoza or something. But you got all these novels and science fiction and everything, and you know, every book in the universe, it's just on and on and on. So there's got to be lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of produced podcasts that is aching to get more distribution, and some of it which will say, well, we're going to do you a favor. We're going to let you rebroadcast just the way Netflix plays old movies that are not popular, haven't been around for years. They pay and they distribute it. We can do that with old WNYC broadcasts or something from 99% Invisible or any other Radiotopia programs or any other package. We got two functionalities, production and distribution. Production and distribution. And we should, and both of those can be within the mission statement.
Right.
You don't have to do a production, but you can. You can do a production. We're doing it. We're doing old time murder mysteries or something, The Shadow or something. As part of a cultural effort. So that's the key way to look at it in terms of technology too. And we had a radical thing that happened in 2020 because the shops closed down. So everybody had to produce at home. So everybody did it at home. I think we could turn most of the stations into clothing stores because everything can be produced at home for the most part. You just need a place to technically connect to the tower and archive stuff and so forth. But you don't need studios that much. Studios are much less in demand because everybody's now the equipment, now we got our own mics and Zoom and everything else. And so everybody did. They did their production at home. Nobody went into KBFK except maybe one guy, So that's all. And I think that's the key thing is to talk about this is technology for production and technology for distribution.
All right. Let me ask Bruce. Bruce.
That's it. I'm going to talk.
All right. Thank you. Now, Bruce, as you described your relationship with Michael when he talked about how he created that textbook radio station, it's like he's taking a guided tour. But yeah. I want to get your, to me, production is very important. And I want to get your thoughts about radio production. What is, in your experience, what do you teach people? What do you stress? Because you listen to us talk. I've produced radio. A lot of us here have done that. But I want to get your sense of what you think are the best elements in terms of producing radio. What do you convey to your students in the past?
The one course that I taught for 30 years that I had more fun teaching than any other was audio production and performance, because that was the course that allowed for the greatest amount of creativity and flexibility on the student's behalf. That's when I came to know the students that I was working with, what their intellectual capacities were, what their avocations were, what things interested them, where they wanted to invest their time and their thought and their energy into using radio as a means of expression. And as Jim and I were talking yesterday, nothing did more to enhance that experience than the evolution or the migration, perhaps, from analog production techniques to digital production techniques 20 years ago. Because, I can speak only for the most part, for my experience in education, where there was not a lot of money in my department for equipment. And we had nice analog facilities, nice studios, nice laboratory studios for students to go in and complete their assignments and to experiment with. But it was basically a two-track situation. And when digital audio workstations first became available to us, now you could teach multi-track production techniques, not by drawing it out on the chalkboard, but actually putting them in the studio and turning them loose with, 99 tracks to play with. You've got this field out here. Go sow it with seed and paint me an audio picture. Digital just revolutionized my world from a teaching perspective. And it opened the door to so many, interesting projects that my students did. Let's say students from 2000 forward that I never saw coming from students from the 1980s and the 1990s. It really equipped them, intuitively to make the most of their creativity.
Interesting. Now Kenny was talking about a lot of the, you know, sort of the particular issues with what we have to deal with in this network. What are sort of the, you know, what are the best practices with production that you would convey to your students? And how, I mean, cause you're right. I do think digital editing techniques have revolutionized everything. That's for sure. I'm familiar with Final Cut. I'm familiar with, Audacity. I'm familiar with Pro Tools. I'm familiar with both film and radio editing. So I know how amazing it is. But in terms of best practices, you know, in terms of listening, like when you're trying to build audience through production, what are the kind of things you thought about in your teaching? And what have you, ruminated about over the years?
Well, if you, you know, from a purely technical perspective,
yeah,
learn how to read a goddamn VU meter.
Yes.
Learn about audio levels. Learn to respect good, clean, decent audio. Learn to hate distortion. Learn to hate noise. These are tools that just as in any profession, need to be used correctly. You need to be used wisely. So many times, an otherwise rather decent production was just, really black marked because of distortion and or noise or just, you know, sloppy production technique in that regard. Learn respect for silence. I always tried to help them understand that that's a creative, production technique when used properly. I'm a stickler for good microphone technique and try to help them understand how to take any given microphone. Doesn't matter what it's directionality is. It doesn't matter if it's a cardioid or ribbon or condenser. They could take any microphone and work with it in a studio and learn how to work that mic, learn what it can do, learn what it can't do, and discover what it can't do, and then apply what you've learned when you're actually in production. These are the kinds of things that you're thinking about?
These are like important basic 101s that I think are very important to stress. Because so often, for example, we'll have people who come on the air and they don't know anything about using mics. And community radio can sometimes have that flaw. What was referred to earlier in terms of Radiolab in New York, NYC got a large amount of the money that CPB allocated to do podcast production. So they were getting some really interesting work being done in New York as a result of that. They, at one point, I think they had like $10 million a year going to them. So they had a lot of money. The question of mic placement, what other sort of practical things would you convey because we would share this, your discussion with people coming into the system and learning how to use radio. So what advice would you have for them technically these days? What sort of technical issues or kinds of the new technologies they should try to work with to creatively, besides the digital editing, what is your sense of these new methods of delivering sound?
This goes back 20 years when I first began with digital audio workstations, and for whatever we all recall hearing 20 years ago that if you needed help with a computer, go find a third grader somewhere. It seems like there was this mentality that any child, any young person between the ages of 10 and 20 came into this world a computer geek, a computer specialist, and had all the answers to all of the questions. And semester after semester, time and time again, I found students completely baffled, and maybe sometimes in tears in a production setting, trying to organize their work because they didn't understand a Windows file system at its very basic nature. They did not know folders. They did not know tree structure. They did not know how to create a folder. They didn't know how to name a file. They didn't know how not to name a file. And all of this effort, all of this good work that they were capable of doing, they couldn't manage it. They did not know the computer environment. Now, I can't say, you know, in retirement, how much better it is today than it was a generation ago. But I was just, it just really bowled me over to think how poor their computer management skills were when we first started in digital audio production. So, you know, rule number one, you can't function in that digital domain if you don't understand how your computer works. Second, and this is closely allied to that, for the most part, my experience has been with, Adobe Audition from, I guess, version one up to whatever the current CSS iteration is. And when I had, projects where students first began to understand what an edit decision list is and learning how to organize files within that, and they were so inefficient or so lackadaisical about names that they gave files that if they, you know, in the pressures, let's say, of commercial radio, where they have to maybe go in, edit, change something around in a production very quickly, and they're mousing through the file structure, wondering why the sound effect of a honking car horn, they've named something like Eddie's Foot Smells .wav. And they would just give these ridiculous names to files that were no more descriptive of the content than anything. And they just lost valuable time in a production studio because they were not well organized and not very thoughtful, not very mindful of managing their content. So that's another sore spot with me for them to take a lackadaisical approach to managing the file structures.
Interesting. In terms of training people for radio production, what were your what did you learn from teaching in terms of how you can get somebody up to snuff to sort of be acquainted or able to handle audio production? How long did it take to sort of acquaint somebody coming in fresh from your experience? And what sort of things would you try to emphasize in teaching them?
In that production course that I referenced a while ago, in a good semester, I could probably make five step-tiered, if you will, production assignments, each one of them bringing a little more complexity, something different to the equation. But it began with a piece of 30-second PSA copy. Can you go into the studio and demonstrate that you can open a mic, make a recording, save it, move it to a flash drive, submit it to me, let me evaluate. Let me get down to the basics of simple board operation, simple software operation, simple microphone usage. And for any number of years, I took an Ad Council PSA pertaining to volunteer IRS service, and it very cleverly, within 30 seconds, used six or seven different sound effects as time-saving mechanisms. So there was a ticking clock to indicate the passage of time. There was a sound of an old-fashioned cash register to indicate the use of accumulating and spending money, so forth and so on. And so I deconstructed that, gave them the copy, gave them the sound effects files, had them put that together, and let them work with that. And that taught them, that was an introduction to multi-track production technique, where I'd have them put voice in one track and sound effects in a separate or multiple tracks beyond that. You got to bring it in on the nose at 30. You got to save it. You got to understand how to mix it down to a file, get a final mix down out of it. And so from there, after that lab exercise, we went into commercial and or public service production. That was the third major exercise, and that was one where we spent a good bit of time. I had the good fortune of having a colleague who taught in my department's advertising sequence, and so a copy for radio commercials and PSAs that her students produced in her advertising laboratory then became the scripts that my students would produce as finished commercials or finished announcements. And her students turned out some very nice, many times slice of life kinds of scripts, things productions that had real possible production value that could be infused into them. It was not, you know, the furniture sale of the week down at Harry's. These were nice scripts. And, so the students always looked forward to doing those. We would hold casting sessions for voice actors to come in and voice these scripts. And I think they learned an awful lot in that semester in that class, that was real world useful to them. But I want to diverge for just a moment, because going back to some of the previous contests, one of the questions I wanted to ask was, is there a description of the Pacifica Farm team? Who out there, I'm trying to get a photograph in my mind of who is coming along in Pacifica that maybe has no experience, but for whatever reason thinks they have a voice that needs to be heard. Describe that person to me.
That's an interesting question. Others can chime in.
And I guess by way of caveat, let me explain, because almost entirely the kinds of students that were coming into my classroom were those who came to the university already enamored with radio and already convinced that, for many of them coming from the St. Louis area, that they were going to come and go through the 6-course sequence of radio courses at my university and then go back to their hometown of St. Louis. And, that was where they were going to begin. St. Louis was their entry level market, and, you know, trying to help them understand that St. Louis was not an entry-level market for radio people. That was a challenge in and of itself. But the students that I was working with, by and large, were people who saw themselves as future, sort of in a destiny to be on the radio. You just need to tell me what I need to do in order to be successful. I'm wondering how to compare those students as a group with whatever the current lineup of people in the Pacifica Farm team right now might be. They may, you know, have no real radio aspirations per se, but certainly may have content that they want to produce and disseminate.
Right. They certainly have content. That's for sure. I'm sure everybody has a different, everybody on this panel has a different opinion about that. What is very useful was to hear you discuss how you trained people in a production, setting. There are people who are not on the call today who actually run training programs inside their radio stations. I would say from my personal experience, the people who I've seen over the years come in have all different motivations. Some people are indeed burning to be broadcasters. I mean, they have traditional ideas about getting on the air, become DJs, to become talk show hosts, to become, in some cases, in the news departments when we had them function. Many people would come through and then ultimately wind up in television.
But are they showing up at your door because they're disillusioned with commercial radio?
Well, I would say that the average person who would be attracted to something like a Pacifica radio station is in and of themselves disillusioned with commercial radio. I would say that that's, others can chime in on that one. I mean, the whole Pacifica mission statement, which is controversial, is crafted after World War II by COs who basically argued that the station should try to resolve, because they of course were disturbed by the, you know, the breakdown and you know that occurs during the war, the onset of the nuclear age. So their whole part of the mission statement was to try to explain the causes of conflict. That's in the mission statement of Pacifica. Another part of it is that some of them were of course in the Bay Area. So the Bay Area at the time was sort of, as we know, in terms of our knowledge of contemporary American culture, the Bay Area becomes the sort of ground zero for the beatnik movement, etc. So a lot of people involved with Pacifica, like Lawrence Ferlinghetti or different artists and writers. And so in the mission statement, there is a designed a part of it that talks about commitment to the arts, commitment to the theater, commitment to orchestral. I mean, it's and people don't follow it that much, but it's in there is a commitment to the arts. So a lot of people, of course, given the way the foundation evolved in the past 50 years, the need for voices of the disenfranchised to express themselves, the different, you know, there were clamors during the 60s, the whole nature of the stations transformed itself completely with black, Hispanic, Asian American, Native American voices come in to want to have an outlet to express their political opinions. So it's a mixed bag across. The main problem in terms of what you're saying is that there has been a breakdown over the past 50 years, as far as I'm concerned, with the kind of things you're talking about actually training people about how to do broadcasting, how to do radio. Little like the exercises you're talking about, I had those kind of things when I came in because I had a person, I sought that out. I went out after that kind of training myself. But in terms of formalizing that kind of training within each station to create a nurturing environment to sort of transmit skills to broadcasters, I could say that that's not true in all the stations, but let me have other people jump in. You know, Ken, Nancy, Bruce, Tom, and also the technology issue is a very important one because I think now the technology is much more democratic. You know, anybody can learn Audacity. Anybody can learn Audition. You know, you're using Adobe Audition. Those tools are not that difficult. Audacity, by the way, is so easy to learn. And Audacity is not that different than learning Adobe. So the tools are there, and that's what's interesting to me, the democratization of the tools. But, you know, I think the problem, the reason I bring up the production issue, and Kenny brings it up, is that that particular issue, the emphasis on production, on quality of production in general, the tenets of production, that has fallen by the wayside in the past 30 years, I would argue. Others may disagree with me, but I think that's been the case. But do other people want to chime in on this issue? Mike, Kenny, Nancy, Bruce, Tom?
Okay, Nancy from KPFT in Houston.
Go on, Nancy.
The students from broadcasting students that come to KPFT, they come as a level getting a taste of experience, and then they go off to try to get a salary at another station, commercial radio station. So Pacifica here in KPFT is 100% volunteer programmers. So we have a hard time getting interns because they don't see any advantage besides credits for their school record, but they don't see a long-term future there. Money, because of money.
And just to further add to that, Bruce, in my experience in the news department at BAI, we had a very robust news department maybe 20, 30 years ago. And the J schools in New York would supply a lot of people. A lot of people would come in to do radio. And it was true that everybody was coming in to get that experience, and they'd go off and get a job in the regular, usually television. And I don't really fault them for that. But that's because actually if you learn how to do news editing, I think that has a great applicability to doing radio production. If someone's trained,
they recognize Pacifica for the tradition and for the excellence, and then come take some advantage of it and then move on.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I think the core attraction for Pacifica is really a dedication to the content that aligns with the mission, which is that it is not commercial, corporate, mainstream media. And, we were just talking about people coming in to get training and leaving. You have to think about the attraction, both short-term and long-term. If people just want to be doing radio, then they're going to go for the higher salary, and there is really no attraction to Pacifica per se. But if they are interested in the content of what we're doing, then that's going to attract them, and they're going to stay. And I think the attraction to getting the content out there comes first, and then the people teach themselves the technology. Because that's the way to make it work. And they learn radio techniques, second. I think there are sometimes people who hang around the station and, learn a lot of the technology and, keep doing more and more of it and, and may get into it that way. But, the real attraction is the, meeting the mission statements content that does that.
Yeah, and in the early 70s, NPR, when it was first founded, a lot of the staff that went down to the NPR station when they created National Public Radio, there were a disproportionate amount of veterans from Pacifica radio stations. In New York, at least six of the people who went down to, actually became, strip morning show and afternoon hosts at NPR nationally were from BAI. Their UN reporter, Margot Adler, she was from BAI. So what was lost, I think, in the transition into the 70s was there was an internal, sort of like self-taught kind of thing, because back then FM radio, as you know, was the cutting edge. FM radio in the 60s was the cutting edge. It was the equivalent of doing digital radio and podcasting now. That's not the case anymore. People don't have to go to a Pacifica station if they want to do stuff. As Michael raised earlier, people can create their own content and do something different. So it's not the same cachet that it was 50 years ago.
Maybe not in content and production, but in dissemination and distribution. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it would seem like they could see, guaranteed delivery to a potential audience, via Pacifica or by radio broadcasting, as opposed to putting a podcast out there and trying to, publicize it and bring people to attract them to come in and listen or download the podcast.
Right. That's very true. What did occur in Pacifica in the late 80s was, and this was sort of reflective of what was going on in NPR, was I remember there was a particular year at NPR during the Reagan administration when there was like a 50% cutback in NPR. I forget, it was some, I think it was 83, 84, 85. And then there was this big precipitous drop. And then after that, there became this drive in Pacifica, or rather in NPR, to try to survive. And so I know back then they cut down radio drama. They cut down a lot of things they were doing in the arts. And then they moved to essentially a market-driven, to some extent, way of producing radio. So, for example, the Nielsen ratings, the Arbitrons, became particularly important. I know that back then, you know, we used to have Giovannini came into the picture as the guru of how to craft strip programming. And, you know, and I learned a lot from him. But I also learned that, you know, the problem with that is that, you know, strip programming, of course, is the source of aggregate listener growth. But the problem with strip programming from the point of view of Pacifica was that, you know, you had all these eclectic programs who did not have inputs of, frankly, basic radio production techniques like you've been talking about. I mean, I know so many people who weren't trained at all. They had to learn this themselves. And then these guys are sitting there fighting for audience, and their audience basically is fragmentary. So you have this big clash. The clashes that have been going on in Pacifica for the past 30 years have been basically derived from these kind of conflicts. To this day. And that the latest conflict was over the fact that the Cumes for the whole network have declined about 60% since 2000. And so everybody's, and as a result, the amount of money coming in has declined. And so so this creates tremendous division, tremendous animosity and acrimony. And so the question is how to get out. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we have to create good content to attract people. That's the way to get out of it.
Jim, you mentioned some time ago about the feds plowing a lot of money into WNYC to broadcast content. And Bruce, you were talking about podcasts. And Bruce, you were talking about distribution. The internet is famously a winner-take-all proposition. Radio is by definition, you know, no matter what Clear Channel does with it, local, and tailored to the community when it's terrestrial. But the internet, the classic example is, you know, if you start, digitizing college courses, the really good professor gets all of the students throughout the country, et cetera. And everyone else gets left by the wayside, or, you know, the really popular musicians get the concentration. So there's always that danger. The WNYC has talked at its community board meetings, community advisory board meetings, about how it, in essence, they intend to take over public radio for the entire nation, become the public radio station for everywhere, and they can do that with the winner take all, attracting the audiences away from local radio stations because they're more highly produced. And by pumping in tons of money into the podcasts, which are therefore internet and internet focused, that infusion of Fed money was an assistance to WNYC in that. And if you look at their podcasts, you'll find that they're basically corporate narrative, compatible podcasts. And they, you know, have been pulling the center of gravity of WNYC, you know, over in a right wing or more corporate compatible direction.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that Michael raises with the concentration on WNYC radio as sort of the premier NPR station in the country. They have a budget. They had a budget before the pandemic of about $100 million a year. So they were probably the best funded NPR station in the United States. Some of the shows I don't necessarily think. I think the shows that they do on Saturday.
Did you say $100 million a year?
That's right, $100 million a year. they had a huge budget. And, you know, you're talking about a Pacifica radio station in all. I think the whole budget of all of them combined is about, what, $8 or $9 million at this point. And BI went down from 3 to 1.5. So the amount of money that could be available, I also think the community radio stations and Pacifica in particular did not, for a variety of reasons, take advantage of the fact that there was money out there to have invested in podcasting. So there's been, to me, and this is gets down to the internal problems because they basically lost their CPV funding a few years ago and were in the middle of getting it back. But there has been the inability to get inputs of grant money to basically experiment with podcasts. And podcasting to me is not a guarantee. You know, it's, you know, Serial, it had the cachet of coming out of Ira Glass's operation in Chicago and was the largest and most well heard of podcast, operation in the country. I think after that, the New York Times is number two or number three. And all these things are very well produced. I've gone to events where I've seen these guys talk to people involved with this. So, you know, a lot of what they're doing, of course, is good radio. And I think, you know, when I was talking to you, you had a sort of mixed bag attitude about all these podcasts you've been hearing. What's your thoughts about that, Bruce? What do you sense with all the evolution of podcasts?
Some really good stuff out there and some real drivel. And for me personally, you know, how do you separate the wheat from the chaff? It's a fishing expedition every time I, you know, want to try something new on my morning walk. It's really hard to get noticed.
Yeah.
Jim, if I may, this is
Rourke. Go on, Tom.
Yeah, I'm going to have to sign off here pretty soon, but a couple of things. I want to know if I can, Bruce, is your curriculums, are they on a website anywhere, or, you know, is it possible to just get an email and contact you later about that? And the same with Karen. Ken Aaron, questions that might occur later. But I was thinking about my experience a couple of things. One, a drive through the South a couple of years ago, and, you know, you listen to commercial radio in the car, but I found myself calling up YouTube on my phone and plugging it in the auxiliary channel and sort of, expanding what was available to me on the drive. And I know that that's sort of become a habit. And YouTube, of course, I'm aware that, and I have a couple of, you know, shows that I listen to regularly, Jimmy Dore, The Gray Zone, and some of them are experiencing, you know, YouTube, demonetization. And suddenly, you know, is a form of censorship. And now they're gravitating to places like, Odyssey, a podcast called Dark Horse by Brett Weinstein, who I recommend is a brilliant, evolutionary biologist. And he's been told by YouTube, you know, he's talking about ivermectin and COVID-19 and these things that the mainstream media just wants to, you know, doesn't even want to talk about. And he's had to gravitate to a channel called Odyssey. I saw that Max Blumenthal of the Gray Zone is starting to broadcast on Ronkin. So we're aware that, you know, it occurs that this is a phenomenon where broadcasters who are saying what they believe to be, you know, controversial, or it's evident that it's controversial truths, they're truths that are being, you know, told by the mainstream, you know, by Google and who owns YouTube and Facebook, that they're broadcasting misinformation. They don't want to accept that. And so they're ultimately looking for, you know, other channels. Pacifica was, you know, had some sort of grand marketing strategy to gather these, and just contribute to their distribution by, you know, having them available on our channels. I'm sure that would be, something I'd be interested in, and I know a lot of other people would too. Go ahead.
I made three notes as you, spoke, and I understood you to say that you need to drop out of the conversation. So the first note, is simply to say thanks for, inviting me to be a part of this discussion today. I'm just, you all don't know how, pleased I am to know that you, have recognized the work that John and I have done. And we're honored, even though John could not make it, to the discussion today, I'm honored that you all invited me to be a part of this. I am terribly honored. So thank you for that. You ask about, any of my content, being on the web. It's no longer because I'm 3 years into retirement now, but certainly all of my content resides on this computer in front of me. And, I'd be more than happy to share any and all, anything that you might be interested in. Please reach out to me and let me know. And I'd be happy to share, you know, whatever. And then the third thing.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, just as a general comment to everyone, how many are familiar with the Broadcast Education Association, with BEA?
Oh, yeah, I am. Sure. Yeah, I am.
Okay. My co-author, John Hendricks, is 2 years ago was president of BEA, and I have had over the years several areas of responsibility in leadership. There are two of, I think, 16 interest divisions that I want to call your attention to, and I'm a member of both. One is the group of people that are in the radio and audio media interest division. And then, and many of us, because of what we did in the academy, also belong to an interest group called the Student Media Advisors. And anything that John and I can do to help you guys reach out to the membership, of these interest divisions or to BEA in general, we have maintained, a fairly strong syllabus exchange over the years. But if you're interested in learning more about anything that's going on in the academy, in terms of how, we are trying to prepare students, you know, that information is out there. And I know that the leadership in these groups would be, just pleased to know of your interest and willing to help you guys in any way that they can.
Well, that's great.
And it's an international organization. So, there's just a lot of collective knowledge out there in terms of, student instruction.
Yeah, that's great, Bruce.
I wanted to, say that I endorse everyone that you, mentioned, listening to, and by the way, Jimmy Dore was, you know, a Pacifica staple for quite some time.
Yes, I've gathered that, yes.
And if you've been listening to him, apparently he was, he wound up off the air because of a dispute, with the Los Angeles station management, the program director and the GM there, when he was, questioning Fauci's reliability.
Yeah.
So there you have a situation where the, center of gravity is being pulled away from us to the internet. And it's hurting us because now, the time that you might be spending listening to Pacifica and the fundraising that used to be done with the Jimmy Dore show when he was broadcasting through Pacifica, you're now going to be spending that time on the internet, you know, with the other availability of Dore there. But, you mentioned plugging into, YouTube. And one thing to realize is that, YouTube has something, going with it operationally that we don't have. There's the YouTube algorithms, and that involves the data scraping that goes on. You can call that a kind of corporate surveillance, except Google, you know, plugs into the government anyway. So it's, you know, just plain surveillance. And along with the data scraping, it's not just surveillance, because the data scraping is done for the purposes of what you get with YouTube, which is through the algorithms, a micro targeting of the next thing that you're listening to, because they said, well, you like this, so you're going to like that. And we're not operating with any of that, could be viewed as a handicap, but it also means that there's a freer, more democratic environment.
All right. Well, listen, I wanted to just get some final comments to Bruce before we go. I want to thank Bruce so much for taking time to talk with us, because it's very valuable. We'd like to have you come again sometime down the road. John is welcome to. Michael, we already have extended an invitation to. Our objective is to get as many different folks involved in the academy in terms of radio teaching and production involved to have a dialogue about technology and think about what we need to do to reconfigure and create new kinds of forms of broadcasting. Cause that's what we want to come out with. What we're doing here. We're the technology committee of the foundation or task force. And we want to sort of think out loud about what to do. And yes, your syllabi would be much appreciated. We'd love to see that. Tommy could send it to me, to my email. I'll distribute to all these folks here. We would definitely want to, have a creative process introduced to really rethink how we're going to survive in the 21st century, how to create something new and different and exciting and has a mass effect on the population of the United States and the world. Frankly, that's what I'm into. And that can be done. It's not impossible. Yes, anybody have other questions or comments? Go on, Bruce.
Okay. No, I didn't mean to interrupt, but before we all part company, there is one final comment I'd like to make.
Yes, sir. All right. Let me just hear what people want to ask you before we go. Any other comments to Bruce?
Well, I was going to say, this is O'Rourke. One thing I forgot to mention was, and maybe you can answer this. In the case of Jimmy Dore, in the case of the Gray Zone, in the case of Richard Wolf, who is on Pacifica, all of them seem to be, they're independent content producers who seem to be getting paid. And the show I volunteer with on the ground, which is Esther Avaron's show, and she's, she as well. They're getting paid through Patreon somehow, a certain amount. And I guess that's the sustaining them. Is that what I am led to believe? Cause, I am not like you guys, a radio professional. I'm a rank amateur and, sort of coming at it very late. But, I'm a discerning listener and I'm a political person as well. But, so I use stuff that I, was useful to me. But, somehow, at some point I remember hearing Pacifica demanded that it be recognized they own everything that's broadcast through their airwaves. They seem to be saying that, but that's clearly not the case anymore, because these independent producers that are being distributed via Pacifica are also distributing to other places and getting paid in some way. At least a subsistence amount to continue to do that. Is that the model we're dealing with? Cause you said the frustration of training people. And by the way, seems like Berkeley's the only one that still has a formal training, or currently has a formal training program. Everyone else, they've existed in the past. In PFW, they don't exist. It doesn't exist, even though we've talked about it. So is that, the frustration of training people and then them going off because they do want to make a career of it and have to get paid at some point. They don't have another income stream to rely on. Is this sort of what we should expect to do, that, you know, we train people and then, you know, basically, hopefully they're in line with our content and they're going to produce something similar or, you know, or alternative or quirky that they can, you know, give to us and sell to others, you know. Is that what we're looking at?
Well, let me give you an example of someone we trained and how that benefited us. We trained somebody who actually won an Emmy Award during the Vietnam War. He covered, he was actually in Vietnam for several years for Pacifica. He later went to work as the right-hand person for Walter Cronkite and more or less stayed with CBS until he retired a few years ago. So you have all these people throughout the mainstream media who have been our allies. I mean, you know, people have to keep that in mind. It's not like they're our enemies. They're our allies. They may not like what they hear sometimes, but they're going to defend the right to have freedom of expression. So, and the issue you raise about the ownership issue, forget that. We could have a whole session on that. So I'd rather let Bruce have the last word than to get into that right now, because that is a big, big can of worms. Go on, Bruce, your last comments.
My precursor to my last comment was, isn't that lament about personnel that would come in and use you or use your facilities for training and then move on to greener pastures, if that's the appropriate word. That's the lament of every small market radio and TV broadcaster, isn't it? It's all, everybody's always looking for, you know, the training and moving up to the next level. For 20 something years, I was advisor to a student laboratory radio station, and I just had to accept that just as soon as I had been able to cultivate a staff of students that were capable of managing and operating the station, you know, at the end of that year, I had to say goodbye to many of them and start afresh again next September. So, you know, it's a revolving door. But in terms of closing comments, I mentioned this to Jim yesterday. I didn't dwell on it, but I think it's worth sharing with all of you. John Hendricks and I inherited Michael Keith's wonderful textbook, The Radio Station, about 10 years ago. We have seen it through two editions, and I think it's time that John and I move on. I'm in retirement now. John has some other professional commitments. And so we're in discussion with our publisher in London as to whether or not John and I will proceed to produce an 11th edition of the radio station. I don't think that we will be the ones doing it, although the publishers are asking us to recommend people in the academy who might be interested in carrying forth the legacy of Mike's great work. And if that be the case, if John and I choose not to continue this, but would be working very closely with our successors, this would be an excellent time for the Pacifica voice to be heard, to provide input that can shape the thinking of who will be developing the next edition of this textbook, to make certain, as best as possible, that it meets the needs of its readership. So I'll keep you guys posted on developments with that, but I suspect that the next edition will be under new authorship, and this would be, as I said, a wonderful time for them to be hearing from you all in terms of how the book could benefit you in training and educating the people that you're working with.
Well, thanks. That's a great prospect. And I want to thank you so much, Bruce, for taking the time to share your thoughts with us. We look forward to hearing you again down the road. Any kind of things you want to share with us, we'll certainly look forward to hearing you talk down the road, because, as you know, I wanted to bring you out of retirement to hear your thoughts about all this today. And as I say, we're going to have a constant series about this. You're more than welcome to come as we do it. But we want to get the best kind of minds in the country and in the world talking with us about what the hell we can do to really create a rejuvenated Pacifica Foundation in terms of its audio production.
Well, I want to say thanks again to all of you. I'm very honored by this invitation. I really am.
Well,
it's been just a thoroughly enjoyable experience for me. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Uh-huh.